meaning that I've studied certain properties of solutions of PDE by using the tool of a function space and the further tool of estimates of a variety of operations on function space. Convolution, Fourier transform, such like. So I'm going to spend the remainder of the day going through, probably I won't even write down a partial differential equation. Actually, I'll write down one. But I'd like to go through a set of function space inequalities that compare different function spaces that are principal tools in partial differential equations. And I had reasons to talk with you about convolution and further reasons, and PDE reasons, and partial differential equations reasons for to talk with you about inequalities involving LP spaces in the Fourier transform. But I have, at the moment, less direct reasons other than my assurance. These come up all the time as tools in the analysis of partial differential equations, particularly nonlinear partial differential equations. That's my excuse today. Now I'm going to do analysis inequalities, or what some people call calculus inequalities. So maybe I'll write that down, calculus inequalities. So, let's see. And it's actually often a big mistake in a PDE course that you write down one partial differential equation and then you spend the rest of the semester studying these things. So we'll just compactify, so to speak, and put it all in one lecture. And to tell you the truth, my goal is to finish at noon today. So we even have a short session. Okay, so the first and maybe the most famous, or at least the general and useful theorem, is what people call, a lot of ones are called this, but this is the principal one, called the Sobolev embedding theorem. And that goes back to a little bit of a statement, which is all these inequalities among Banach spaces. You have a Banach space B1, and you have a function U in B1, and then you have another Banach space B2. And the question is, does U in B1 imply that U is in B2? And that's like saying that everything in B1 is in B2, or B1 is a subset of B2. So if you can answer that question, then you say that B1 is embedded in B2 as a linear space. And furthermore, often you show that U is in B2 being in U in B1 by something like this. You look at the B2 norm of U and then show it's bounded above by some constant less than the B1 norm of U. And then that implies, as long as this is finite, this is also finite. So as long as this holds, then this also holds. So that's a typical situation that we're working with. We're going to show an inequality, that's analysis, and then that will imply something about the embedding. And this just says B1 sits inside B2, but often it's interesting if B1 sits inside B2 compactly. So also, one is interested in if B1 sits inside B2, but as a compact set. So a compact embedding. So today, I think I'm concentrating just on whether they sit in the space, but I'll say whether they're compact or not as we fly through them. Question. Q for question. A for answer. Sorry? It's like a compactness theorem. Of course, a linear space can't be compact, but it can be a neighborhood of linear space near the origin can be compact. So compact embedding would say that, and compactness, exactly, you can say in terms of spaces. So what you can say is a bounded sequence in B1 turns out to be a convergent sequence in B2. That says you take the unit ball in B1, map it to B2, that's a compact set. You can't take all of B1 because it's a linear space, but you can take a compact space, you can take a bounded piece of B1 and it's a compact piece of B2. Okay? Shall I say the Sobolev embedding theorem? Let F be a friendly function in an HS space. And also a comment today is I'm going to mostly work over Rn. Yet, occasionally, I need to work over a bounded domain or something more limited than just all of Rn. And I'll tell you when. This is the classic theorem. With S greater than n upon 2, n is the dimension, S is the degree of Sobolev space. Does everyone remember what this space, how to characterize this space? Yes. Then, in fact, F is in L infinity. In fact, F is bounded. And what we're going to do is conclude more, slightly more than the traditional Sobolev embedding theorem. We're going to conclude that, in fact, F is in the CD of Rn. And so that says, among other things, that every time when you're in this Banach space, the Hilbert space, you're also in that space. So HS fits inside CD. And in fact, it turns out it sits inside it compactly. So this is a fact, and what I'll show is it sits inside. So just a reminder. So just a reminder, what does it mean to be HS? Well, let's take a case S is equal to an integer. S is an integer, I guess a non-negative integer. Then I take U. So what does it mean that U is an HS? Then I take U, and then I take dx to the alpha of U, and I take its absolute value, and I square it. And I want to know whether that's L2 for a certain range of multi-indices alpha. So what I'm going to do is sum over all alpha less than or equal to m, and integrate. So integrate outside a sum, it's like integrate same as integrating inside the sum. And I'm going to call that, that's like saying I'm taking the sum of alpha less than or equal to m of the L2 norms of the dx alpha u squared. And if I also take the square root, then, well, just define this. So this is the definition of u HS norm, alpha less than or equal to S, that's what I mean. M has become S. S has become M. Let me clear this up. Alpha less than or equal to S. HS and squared, because you're supposed to take a square root to get a homogeneity, right? Linear homogeneity, order one homogeneity. I can write this on the Fourier transform side. So I can say U H S squared is equal to a sum of alpha less than or equal to S dx U squared. I can write that in using the Poincaré theorem, something in terms of U hat squared L2. And dx to the alpha is Ix to the alpha. And, of course, you can see this as some integral of some large polynomial here. I'll say this is sum alpha less than or equal to S, xi to the 2 alpha, right? 2 alpha close u hat c squared d c. And there's a constant such that this probably depends on s is less than this Japanese symbol to the 2s u hat c squared dx c. Remember the Japanese symbol c. It's just a convenient way of writing 1 plus c squared to the 1 half. Meaning that this is a polynomial. This is a polynomial. This is bounded below by 1 and above by some power of c to the 2s. And this is 2, but they're related by constants because this is a big sum and this is a smaller sum. So just that constant is some constant which regulates the difference. Okay? And but this also has the advantage of s needn't be an integer here. So in general, the u and hs norm over r n, square it to make it easy, is the integral c to the 2s u hat c squared dx c. Sum over r n, but on the Fourier transform side. Okay? General s in r, you're allowed any real number. And it can be negative if you want. Absolute value. It's a polynomial in the absolute value of c. Actually, it's a polynomial in the absolute value of c squared. But when you put this in an L2 norm, you put absolute values around everything immediately. See, this would be the analog of taking this one would be I c quantity to the alpha u squared absolute value. All the i's are immediately eaten. And not only that, you'd have a c to the alpha, which is a product of cj's squared. So it's a function of the c squareds. If I were in dynamical systems, I would say, actually, that's a function of the action variables alone, because the ijth action is cj squared. But that's a unsubstantiated statement right now. Sorry? CD. That's the notation I introduced last time. That's right. You missed last time, I think. Which is continuous and goes to zero at infinity, but with no implied rate. So D, I guess, means descending to zero, decreasing. I didn't want to put zero because going to zero, I've already used zero, and it's in common use to say compact support. Zero. It's not maybe necessarily such a good notation, but in any case, it's the facts of life. I could put an arrow down. Some people put an arrow down, decreasing to zero, but that looks a little clumsy. So D is a nice, good text symbol. And then let's do that. Okay. I need a proof. Well, I did this one first because the proof is easy, given the Poincaré theorem. So... I have to estimate the size of f. So the proof is going to go on a couple steps, and the couple steps are in fact are to catch up with this CD notation. So first I'm going to say that the f has to be bounded. So let's try to get a norm, you know, let's take f at an arbitrary point x, take its absolute value and see if I can get something bigger than it, which is bounded given the hypothesis. So f itself is 1 upon root 2 pi to the n in integral of e to the I c dot x f hat of c dx c. And if I take absolute values inside the integral, it's bounded by this. So this is 1 upon root 2 pi to the n, it's equal to integral of f hat of c dx c. And it's still equal to, if I do the cheap trick of multiplying and dividing by the same thing. This is all integrating over r to the n in Fourier transform, in Fourier space. So I'm going to multiply by c to the s and divide by c to the s. And it's a cheap trick because all I do now is use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. And that says that the first component of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality says I square this up, c to the 2s, f hat of c squared dxc, 1 half. And this is for any s, right? This is for the s in question, which is any real number, to tell you the truth. And that's taking this as one factor, but of course this is the other factor. So let me put that in, squeeze it in. C to the minus 2s dxc to the 1 half. And so the question remaining is, when, and of course this is true no matter what, but of course this factor could be infinite because I'm integrating some polynomial in xi, I've forgotten about f. So let's just ask, when is the constant, the integral bounded? That is, when is this quantity bounded? C to the minus 2s dxc, and we can take a square root, and that's going to be the constant in this inequality. Well, that has to do with, let's take, if s is a negative, that's a positive power of c, and so integrating over Rn is not such a great idea. I mean, it will be infinity, so surely s should be positive, but if it's only a little bit positive, it will be infinity. It has to be positive enough to have this quantity integrable. So we need, in fact, 2s has to be greater than, so this is a decreasing power of r, a 2s power of, a minus 2s power of r at infinity. At zero, it's bounded. We're worried about c goes to infinity. And we have to cancel the volume integral, which is r dn minus 1 dr. So I need 2s. So I need this to be bigger power than 1 upon r when multiplied by that. So I need 2s bigger than n. That's what we'll do it. And this is bounded by some constant, which depends on n and s. And this is bounded by a constant. Oh, and this constant is finite, less than plus infinity. It's equal to a constant. It's less than plus infinity for 2s bigger than n. And so that says s bigger than n upon 2, which is that inequality. And then we're done. Then we're done. Oh, we're not done. I take it back. We now showed that U is bounded. We've shown that U, thus, U is bounded. But let's work back a little bit. This is now our constant. This is something which is finite by hypothesis, and we're bounding above this. So we also note, so we further note that f hat of c is in L1. Let me say this nicer, that f in Hs, Rn, implies f hat of c is in L1. Funny, the L2 powers, they usually don't match other P powers, but here they do. It's F is an L1, because this is the L1 norm of F hat. But a F hat in L1 has an F. Well, we just did that theorem. It was our study of the Fourier transform. An F which 1 is continuous and 2 goes to 0 at infinity. So that says, thus F is not only bounded, but it's continuous, and it goes to zero infinity. In fact, uniformly continuous, it goes to zero infinity. And just to show that uniformly continuous is not the same as continuous over the real line, everyone knows that, right? Why would it be relevant to us? So just reminds me of this as a reminder. F uniformly continuous, I don't want to make up funny notation, but let's for the moment just say, is not the same, is stronger than F continuous. Let me say this. I should say in the result, in fact, uniformly continuous. So it's stronger than F and continuous. I just want to remind you of that by showing you the Schrodinger kernel. S of xt is a 1 upon root 2 pi it to the nth power e to the I x squared upon 2t. 6t non-equal to 0. And let's think about this function. Is it uniformly continuous? The point is, no. It's a very natural function, which has higher and higher oscillations the further you get away from zero. So, in fact, your modulus of continuity that you have to use in order to compare, you know, to understand the continuity of this function has to increase as you tend toward infinity. So this is not uniformly continuous. Just as a reminder to say that that is and could be an issue. Okay, how about that? Now we're done. I had to make that further note. Now we're done. Well, it's an interesting thing that we're taking a function and we're measuring it in some other norm, and we're also mixing in derivatives. They didn't really have derivatives before. And so you can imagine, these are differential equations, you can imagine worlds of comparing different Banach spaces with different numbers of derivatives on the left or on the right with different powers. It can be a huge industry. And in fact, it is a huge industry. I don't want to encourage you to join the industry just for the industry's sake, but I want to say, but our point of studying it is, these are tools when we are looking at the analytic questions. So what I want to do is extend this a little bit, so we know a little bit more. So here's what I want. I'm starting with F. My hypotheses are F or in HS. And I'd like to estimate, we're talking about continuity and uniform continuity, I'd like to actually estimate in a concrete way the modulus of continuity. So I want to estimate the difference. F of x, but I'm going to take about little translation k, minus f of x. I'd like to estimate that above. So let's do that using the fact that we're in Rn and can just conveniently use the Fourier transform. We did this before, a week ago. And now, since all this reference material is already on the board, let's just follow our noses with regard to that. So it says this is less than or equal to 1 upon 2 pi root to the n integral c to the 2s f hat of c squared d c to the 1/2 times, let's see, integral c to the minus 2s, right? But there's this factor. So I'm going to put that here. 1 minus e to the I c dot k squared dxi 1/2. All I did was translate f minus itself, and I did that same line of reasoning, except I left an extra factor. And now let's just examine this factor. When s greater than n upon 2, this is integrable. Well, partly because 1 minus something as high as 1 is at maximum 2, so the square of it is maximum 4. It doesn't really change the fact that it's finite. But we can do a little bit better by doing the following thing. We can say, I could do the following thing. 1 minus e to the I xi dot k for xi fixed, let's say for xi dot k small, e to the I xi dot k looks like 1. So the 1 cancels the 1. And we get an extra term. So what I want to say is this is bounded by xi dot k. In fact, well, this squared is bounded by this squared. Certainly it happens for xi dot k small. And as soon as xi dot k is bigger than 2, it's surely true because it's already bounded by 2. Okay? And so what I want to do is, let me put this on. So what I want to do is steal a little bit of that for the other. So take a little bit. Of that last line, so I'll say that 1 minus e to the I xi dot k is less than or equal to xi dot k. Let me put the squares in, square. And I'll say this is 2 gamma times, so I'll take a piece of it and estimate with that, and I'll take the rest of it and just estimate by 2. 2 to the 2, 1 minus gamma. This is a square, because that's a square. So I used this for 2 gamma powers, and I used just the fact that this is bounded by 2 for the remaining power. Okay, and now absolutely. And I want 0 less than or even to be equal, gamma, less than or equal to 1. I could take it all. And then, as long as this factor c, and now I'm going to write down this last integral again, c to the minus 2s times c dot k to the 2 gamma, which incidentally is less than or equal to c to the minus 2s plus 2 gamma, is integrable. The right-hand side is finite. So what we have is f of x plus k, translate by k, minus f of x, less than or equal to a constant. This term gives me k to the 2 gamma. Times integral xi to the 2s f hat of xi squared dxi 1/2, which is less than or equal to some constant k to the gamma times f the HS norm. But this is a hurdle. This says, that is, the point is, that is, F is Hurler continuous, C gamma on R n, and furthermore goes to 0 at infinity. And what does it mean to C gamma? So a function, just to remind you, F is gamma Hurler continuous when sup over x not equal to y, oh, let me see, sup over k not equal to 0. So k is not equal to 0, but k is anything in Rn, including a small increment, could be large, of f of x plus k minus f of x divided by k to the gamma is finite. And that's what we showed. We gave an estimate for the constant above. So we're interesting sequence of things that we have an HS function, which is, so we from the hypothesis of Sobolev embedding theorem, we're in a Sobolev space. We actually find if the S is high, if the number of derivatives is high enough, these Sobolev spaces are Hilbert spaces, right? The number of derivatives is high enough, the function is in fact C gamma. So that's another way of saying HS is a subset of C gamma, and also decreasing at infinity. So that's really what we've shown. Good. Gamma Hurler continuous. Hurler. Hurler continuous. Which means it's continuous, it's uniform continuous, and there's this power law behavior, control of the modulus of continuity. What's a typical function which is gamma Hurler continuous is a gamma through. So this is, if this were y, and this were the function y to the gamma power, then it can have a singularity like that. There's no derivative at zero, but it still has a quantifies its modulus of continuity at a power of gamma. If gamma were equal to 1, then it may still not have a derivative, but it has to look, its Lipschitz has to look like that. Good, let's move on. Yes, yes, yes. As long as this is integrable. So that says, exactly, thank you very much. I need minus 2s plus 2 gamma has to be less than minus minus n. Right? So it's, right, so it's s is greater than n over 2 plus gamma. Well, let's put it this way. If you get S greater than N over 2, you can always slip a gamma in. So there's some gamma, as soon as you're in the setting where you have a Sobolev embedding theorem, automatically you're Hurler continuous with some gamma. Just slip it in between the two. Anyone, this is what, as long as you're not hitting the two endpoints. Good. Now we're in the mood for making inequalities without reference to a differential equation. Let's go back and I'll make an association with a differential equation. But I'm going to do that on a domain. So this is now another famous one, the Poincaré inequality. So here we exploited the Fourier transform, but on a domain that's a lot more clumsy. So we're not going to have anything to do with the Fourier transform. So I want to do, and this is explicitly for bounded domains. So omegas and Rn is a bounded domain. Bounded domain. And what I want to do is consider functions u, x, in H1. So this is a question where I'm relating functions and its derivatives in an estimate to other aspects of the function. Okay? So what I want to say is that I want U to be an H1 in the domain. But I actually need boundary conditions. Somehow this is not, what I'm going to give you is, doesn't detect whether a change of value of U by a constant. So I want it to behave somehow on the boundary. And the classic case is if I ask for zero boundary conditions. Well, now I have to explain what the space is. It's, I want to take all S in C infinity, which is zero on the domain. Zero on the boundary of the domain. And then I'll take its closure, but it's closure with respect to H1 norm. Meaning I take everything that you can get, everything that this set can get close to, close being you measure the square integral of the gradient. Okay? And on this, for this class of functions, there's a famous inequality, which I guess is our theorem 2 today, which is one of the numerous ones that go under the name of the Poincaré inequality. So the statement is there exists a constant I'm going to call that lambda, it will depend on the domain, such that for all U in this funny space I just defined, there's an inequality that the L2 norm of U over the domain, dx, is bounded above by 1 over that constant times the L2 norm of the gradient of U. And this is so so central that I'm going to not give one proof, you'll give two proofs of this. So two proofs. So again, it's in this theme. I'm on a bounded domain. It's a little different than the last one, but it's the theme of Banach space norms, is a Hilbert space norm, in fact, of derivatives of U bounding other quantities of U. This is the L2 norm of U. Okay? And the previous one, of course, was some kind of L2 norms of higher derivatives of U bounding the L infinity norm of U. Or it's some aspects of its continuity. So I'm going to give two proofs. And the first thing I'm going to say is it suffices to show this for C not infinity, because that's in H01 densely. And so it's a standard argument in analysis to say if you have some inequalities on a dense set and the constant the constant is independent of which element of that dense set, then the inequality has to hold throughout the space. So all we have, so we're just going to assume we have a C0 infinity function, okay? And now let's see what we do. We'll take here's x1 through xn, say, and here's a domain. Somebody says domains always look like potatoes. Well, that's seems to be what I draw in any case. And let's take an x inside the domain. Here's x. And it's a smooth function, so I'm going to say u of x is equal to u of x0, where x0, why don't I just move this down and make this point x0 on the boundary, plus the integral from x0 to x of something, of its derivative. So I'm going to do that the following way. Integral from 0 to d of d by dy of u of x prime and y. So y is in the nth variable, and I made this in the nth coordinate direction. dy. its integral derivative of a smooth function gets me its value. And what's d? Well, d is equal to the distance from x0 up to x, which is just its projection. So this is d. Well, now, and I forgot to do the dramatic step, which is u at x0 is 0, so I don't have to consider that term. That's fortunate. Otherwise, it'd be in our way. It'd bother us. So now I can say I'm supposed to estimate L2 norm, so let me estimate u, but square it. So that's less than or equal to the integral from 0 to d, absolute value integral from 0 to d, dxn, u of x prime, and then this is in, with respect to y, I'm just doing that integral, doing that derivative, dy squared, and I want to do the following thing. I want to divide this by d and put the d outside, but there's a square, so I put a d squared outside. And now this is an average of the values of the derivative between the edge and the center where I'm at that particular x. So I can use just convexity of the squared function to say this is less than or equal to d squared times the integral from 0 to d of the average of the square of the values. So 1 upon d, dxn, u of x prime, y squared, dy. Close. So it's just by convexity of quadratic function. And now this is an x anywhere, and these are... And this is its integral along that ray, and it only gets bigger if I integrate, let me take this d out, so I have a 1 upon d, and it only gets bigger if I go as far as possible. So as far as possible is the diameter of the set. So integral from 0 to the diameter of dxn u x prime y squared dy. U of x is bounded by that. But it's only one integral. It's a one-dimensional integral. So let's integrate all the rest. So integral just for notation's sake, let's say that let's make u identically zero outside. So I can integrate all the other r n minus 1 dx primes. So I integrate all the other r n minus 1 dx primes. And there's no harm in that. So now I've just integrated over all the x1s, so I integrated all vertical sticks. And that's still, but this still is a function of xn. So let me do one more thing, which is finally integrate over the xn variable. So this becomes an integral over rn u of x. I forgot the square. Square dx. And because u is only supported in omega, this is really omega. And now, this integral already integrates dy dx prime, so it's actually a constant. This is actually a constant times the diameter. Now I integrate up to get the rest of the other variables, but the most I get is actually integrate over the diameter. So this is less than another integral of diameter squared times the integral over omega dxn. U x squared dx. And of course, that's only xn. And I didn't really need the diameter of the set, I only needed the xn distance of the set. So you can even choose your axes to make the thinnest distance to get the smallest constant. But in any case, this is definitely less than diameter squared times u in H1 norm. Sorry, that's not what I wanted. Grad u squared L2 norm. So that's proof number one. And we note that whatever constant there is going to be less than or equal to diameter squared just by this analysis, right? Because the diameter squared surely works, but the smaller the constants, the better the inequality. So you might be able to find a smaller constant. Okay, let's do proof two. Proof two. The idea is to view the inequality as the result of a constrained variational problem. So what we want to study, so a constrained variational problem. So I want to look at the following thing. I'm going to look at the energy, so to speak, which is going to be u squared dx, integral over the domain. And I want to minimize the energy over all u in C naught infinity over that domain. But I'm going to constrain it so that the L2 norm, see, of course, if I took the minimum with no constraint, this is zero. Just plug in zero. But I want to minimize it so the L2 norm is 1. Or, equivalently, the L2 norm squared is 1. So it's really looking at, let's call this E of u, and it's really looking at minimizing E of u over the ball radius 1 about 0 in L2 space of the domain. And of course, its minimum is going to be taken, well, if I'm going to jump slightly, its minimum is going to be, if it exists, and what I'm skipping over is we can show that it exists, but if it exists, it's got to satisfy a Lagrange multiplier problem. So this is a Lagrange multiplier problem. Meaning that the variation of the energy at that minimizer, so let's pretend u star is the minimizing, the variation of energy at the minimizer is not necessarily equal to zero. It's only proportional to the gradient of the constraint. So it's going to be equal to lambda times the gradient of the constraint, which is I of u star, where I didn't say what I was. So this is E, and let's make u squared dx integrate over omega. Let's just call that I of u, like the momentum. And if we just work these out, what is the variation of E? There's E. This is the minimum of E. So that's what I've just drawn in brackets is E. What is the variation is, of course, minus Laplacian U star is supposed to be equal to lambda. I didn't put a 2, so it's minus 2 Laplacian U star is equal to lambda times 2 U star, and cancel the 2s. And since U star is in the set, U star has to be equal to 0 on the boundary of the domain. And let's do it the following way. This is an eigenvalue problem for Laplace's equation with Dirichlet boundary conditions on the domain. And I'm going to proceed by saying that these eigenvalues, eigenfunctions exist, and it's the lowest one which gives me the lowest number lambda. And so we've identified actually a sequence of functions which actually satisfies this, which we plug into, which will actually satisfy any equality with the number, and the best number we get is the lowest eigenvalue. So that says that integral of u, so that says the I of u is equal to the integral of u squared dx over omega is bounded above by 1 over the first eigenvalue of the domain with the Dirichlet boundary conditions. Integral over omega grad u squared dx. Well, it's a nice argument. Associating an eigenvalue problem with the extremal. Depends on the domain. If the domain is a box, I'll give it them to you explicitly. Or a sphere, I'll give them to you in terms of Bessel function. But the general domain, it's general harmonic functions, general functions which satisfy this linear elliptic differential equation with the correct boundary conditions. Spherical, you get Bessel. In general domain, you get, if you want to study a very special and important domain, you can get a sequence of eigenfunctions named after you, if you so desire. So, well, let's go back to my comment above, which is note, 1 upon lambda omega is less than or equal to the diameter squared. So what we've just proved is the first eigenvalue of omega is greater than or equal to 1 over the diameter squared of omega. And we had various expressions which even improved this, like that you can squeeze it between, if you take this convex, you squeeze it between hyperplanes, not quite its convex hull, but you squeeze it between hyperplanes, you get the minimum distance, and you choose that to be xn. For example, you rotate it around to get and then that's the number which bounds the eigenvalue below. Interesting association with two problems. So that's two bits of lecturing on the Poincaré inequality. So let's see. There's just to make a comment. This is an L2 type estimate, but one of the themes today is there's LP type estimate. So in fact, a Poincaré inequality in L infinity is very simple. So let's just try an L infinity Poincaré inequality. I'm not sure this really deserves to be called a Poincaré inequality, but at least it's simple, so that's a good thing. So let's see. So this is theorem. I forgot my theorem number. Theorem 2, so this must be theorem 3. So let u n, well, I don't want a general u in L infinity, because C infinity is not dense in it. But I want u to be in C1 omega. And I want it to be with zero boundary conditions. Then u, measured in L infinity, is less than or equal to another constant. I'm going to call d of omega times grad u L infinity. So infinity, infinity, rather than 2, 2. Okay? And the proof, probably even more, the proof is more enlightening than the statement of the theorem, as in many cases. Oh, and what's D? I'll identify D, where D of omega is equal to the maximum of the following thing. You take maximum over X in omega of the distance of X to the boundary. So the proof is, u of x is equal to an integral from 0 to d, a d by ds of u of x of s, ds. where, I haven't said it, well, let's draw another potato. Here's some x. Maybe let's make this slightly more interesting. Sorry? Max. Before its minimum. This is a variational problem for you, but this is a maximum of a distance of the. So this is Coventry in England. It's the farthest point from the boundary. And you want to know how far is Coventry from the sea? I don't know what it is in Canada. Probably somewhere in Winnipeg. Somewhere near Winnipeg. Right? So what I do is I take x of s as a path, and you don't take the one I just did, but you take a path which goes straight to the boundary. Or you can take any path, but any of this is going to be true, and then that's x of s. Nice smooth path. Okay? And then, so where x of 0 is equal to, is in the boundary, and x of d, which is, oh, and I want an arc length. So x of d is at our point x in question. And then we just expand this out. U of x is equal to the integral from 0 to d, grad u of x of s dot x dot of s, ds, and x dot has length 1, so that u of x in absolute value is less than or equal to the biggest u can be over the domain times the length of the path, d. But this is for that particular x. So first you want to say minimize over paths. That's the distance of x to the boundary. And then you have to say, well, I have to make sure it's true this is inequality holds for all x. So then you say, well, where are the furthest x from the boundary? And that's the minimum path for that particular x is this distance from the boundary. And the maximum is what's the worst point when you estimate it like this. And there you are. Where is this? Dot x dot.
What is the argument of gradient?
X of s.
X divided or?
That's x of s. It's a path. You take the gradient of u of value, that's the chain rule. What's d by ds of u of x of s? It's grad u evaluated at x of s dot x dot at s. That's what it is. Good. A sequence of other interesting results. Different. It's an L-infinity estimate. It says you can bound the size of a function by the size of a derivative if you know how far you have to integrate in order to integrate up the derivative from a point where it's zero. It's zero on the boundary. Of course, it needn't be zero everywhere on the boundary for this estimate. It could just be zero on one point on the boundary, but now the constant is different. The constant is the maximum distance from this point to that point at which it vanishes. It needn't even vanish on the boundary. It could vanish somewhere. Okay? So the technique is more important than the statement, to tell you the truth. And it's pretty simple. So here's theorem 4. I want to let u be in W1P of Rn. I'm going to go back to Rn now, and everything else I'm going to say is in Rn. Unperturbed by having a domain in question. And I guess what I'm going to do is, I have some proofs to give you, but in fact maybe I will suppress them for sake of expediency and give you a Christmas present. And I'm just going to say a series of results. I have about four theorems to say which relate norms of functions measured in LP and their derivatives. So here's one. Do I have to say what W1P is? Yes. Then. So let's at least say that W12 is equal to our Sobolev H space H2. It's H1. It's one derivative square integrable. So W1P. So a function f is in W1P when f, LP, and all dx alpha f, LP, let's do it this way, sum over alpha less than equal to 1, is finite. That's the 1, and that's the P. I'm bad for notation. WMP is if you take derivatives up to order M, and I don't need this. I'll just say this. Alpha less than or equal to M, LP. And if I take these to a pth power and this to a pth root, I'll call that the F, the W, M, P norm. Okay? Just replace 2 with P. It doesn't work so nicely with the Fourier transform, but it's just a way of measuring a size of a function. And my limit 4 has something to do with this kind of measuring the size of a function. So let's let U and W1P of all of Rn, then there exists a constant which depends only on the dimension and on P, such that, I should say, then for P less than N, there exists a constant, depends on N and P, such that if I measure U in a funny LP, an LQ space, it's bounded above by that constant times the gradient of U in LP. So in a funny LQ space, then it's bounded by the gradient in LP. Previously, I've had this is between Poincaré and Sobolev, so to speak. Poincaré, I had LP gradient and then LP, the function itself. Here I'm going to have the LP gradient. I'm going to bound something else here, which is NP over N minus P. And I think because of time, I'm going to suppress the proof. But you know what you owe yourselves is to understand why those p powers. And how do you do that? By dimensional analysis. So if those do not fit in our dimensional analysis argument, it is not a theorem. So the first thing you can do is check whether it's dimensional analysis. I'm ready to prove it, but I didn't want to finish in 1.5 hours rather than 2, so I'd rather just go on and make a series of statements. I think there's 3 more statements. It gives you a flavor of what people do when they're working on their analytic tools in this topic. So that's theorem 4. Theorem 5. What happens, this is for P smaller than N. So what happens when P is bigger than N? So let U in W1P of Rn with p bigger than n, then exists a constant c, which depends on n and on p again, such that something is bounded above by one derivative on u, lp. And that something, well, what happens with n when p hits n? I get l infinity. I explicitly do not permit that in my hypothesis, and it's not true. But when p exceeds n, this is a nonsensical space. In fact, when p gets bigger, it should get better. And in fact, what you control is u in a Hurwitz space. And I forgot to write down what the Hurwitz constant is with some beta greater than zero. And I forgot to write down what beta is. Because I want to finish. Okay, we could figure that out with dimensional. It has to be the beta that fits dimensional analysis. So find beta. So here's a question for you, but you don't have to hand it in. Find beta from dimensional analysis. I forgot to note it, and I don't want to take your time to figure it out when I have 10 more minutes to say two more things. Does anyone know what happens when p equals n? Is there something one can say? Well, what's bigger than all p powers, but not quite an infinite power? It's the exponential. So there's an exponential inequality, which is part of the Nirenberg-John inequalities, that fits right between, in this setting, the LP spaces and the L infinity space. Well, that's an interesting fact, which I won't bring up today. So here's theorem 6, and I just have theorem 6 and theorem 7. I'm just going to make statements. So let u in m derivatives pth power of Rn with the number of derivatives greater than n upon p. And I guess m is always going to be a natural number for us, because we haven't thought about, we've only in L2 thought about what it means to be a non-integer derivative. It's possible, but let's not do it here. Okay, so M for our LP space, our WMP space is an integer. So I take an integer bigger than the dimension over P. To do this optimally, you can adjust P. Then, sup over UX. So now I was allowing only one derivative. Now I'm going to allow arbitrarily many derivatives. Sup over X is less than or equal to C U WMP. And let's just check for P equals 2 case, we need the number of derivatives greater than N upon 2, which is Sobolev. My first Sobolev embedding theorem. Okay? And here's my last one. So theorem 7. And this is a sort of the it sort of encompasses all these problems, and surprisingly, it looks a little complicated, but it's surprisingly useful. So this was proved simultaneously, more or less, and certainly independently, and more or less simultaneously by Gagliardo and Nirenberg. The same person who's on trial. The second world war. No, that's Nuremberg. That's the Nuremberg trials. That's a funny joke. That's a location, not a person. The persons are much more infamous. But I must say that location had a lot of infamous people from it. So consider. So I better write this clearly. N-I-R-E-N-B-E-R-G. Berg means mountain. So you can, right? But Nuremberg, Burg, Burg means castle. That's different. So consider which indices. Let's have them P, Q, and R. And they can be infinity too. So we can also talk about L infinity norms. And now how many derivatives? I can have zero derivatives, and I can have up to M derivatives. Oh, but I want J, the number of J of derivatives, to be less than a number of M. Then, the following holds. The sum over alpha equals J of d by dx alpha U in LP is bounded above by a constant times two things. The sum over beta equals M d by dx to the beta U measured in LR to the A power times just U alone measured in LQ, LQ to the 1 minus A power. That says some derivatives of U in LP are bounded by more derivatives of U in LR times U itself in LQ, all balanced with powers A and 1 minus A, where I have to now give you some relations between J, M, P, Q, R, and A. So, for J over M less than or equal to A, strictly less than 1, and 1 upon P equals J over N plus A times 1 upon R minus M over N plus 1 minus A times 1 upon Q. How would I ever find that number? How would I ever find that relationship? Dimensional analysis. It looks funny, but in fact, all it is dimensional analysis. You forget it. I forget it all the time. Just scale everything, give derivatives their appropriate weight. That comes out. Not necessarily. You can adjust. And also, it turns out it also holds, also, this equality holds as long as we don't hit an integer, as long as M minus J minus N upon R is not a non-negative integer, so it's not in the natural numbers. Okay. Well, let me just stop here. Actually, I'll say one more thing. I mean, this looks very complicated and confusing, but let's just say the following thing. If I wanted to estimate the gradient of U in LP in terms of, say, two derivatives, let me just say all two derivatives of U in LR to the 1/2 power and U itself, LQ power to the 1/2 power, then that's an example of this, with a particular number, P's, Q's, and R's worked out. In fact, if it works out, then you need 2 upon P is equal to 1 upon R plus 1 upon Q. Then you can use this, you can prove this. final comment is, vice versa, it suffices only to prove this. Because if you do, then by induction you can prove this. So if you can just get one derivative between two others, then of course you use this not for you, but it's for its derivatives. You do an induction, you can find the whole thing. So let's leave it at that. Thanks for the semester. No, only one partial differential equation today. That was the Laplace's equation on the domain, an eigenvalue problem for Laplace's equation on the domain. And we'll start up next term actually with general theory. So I'm going to start with Hamilton-Ugobi theory of and the method of characteristics for general first-order partial differential equations. Good, thanks.